This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right. Good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Jen Hawk and Dr. Doug Lyle, except no Dr. Doug Lyle today. Dr. Hawk, you're going solo today. How you doing?
I'm good, but, you know, Doug has a very good reason. He's been off working on the book and got his nose to the grindstone. So he's making progress. He sent me some new stuff to look over and wheels are in motion. So it's very exciting.
That's great to hear. I mean, for the first time in a long time, I sent him a text and didn't get a reply right away. And I thought, oh, I hope he's writing this book. I hope he's working on the book. So
he's in self-imposed, you know, book lockdown. So that he and I both very much work that way. That's, why when we're sort of in collaboration mode, we do tend to kind of hide away from the world and work on the book exclusively, because that's just sort of, it's how I wrote my dissertation. That's how he wrote The Pleasure Trap. You just kind of, we're not great at living normal life and writing a book at the same time like some people are. So we have to just kind of like carve out this book time. So that's what he's been doing. So he gets a pass this week.
No, that's great to hear. So we're anxiously awaiting, but we won't hold our breath, but we're anxiously awaiting.
Yeah, so are we. I mean, the problem is that there's, you know, some new shit has come to light in the last 2 years. So kind of where we were 2 years ago with what we, you know, kind of how we thought we wanted to sum everything up and the main thesis of the book. And, not that the main thesis has changed, but obviously the context has massively changed. And we've gone from this perspective on, you know, don't worry about the world, focus on your happiness and your relationships and, basically freedom in an unfree world. But now we're really confronted with, you know, freedom in an unfree world has taken on new meaning. And so we have to consider the external world and how it is changing and how it's affecting our potential decision matrix in a really new way. So we've had to add a bunch of new stuff and rethink some things. So it's thrown a bit of a wrench in the gears.
Well, I'm excited nonetheless, but I can imagine if you guys had released it, you know, December of 2019.
I know. Oh, we talk about that all the time. We'd be like, oh my God, what, this is a disaster.
You'd have to write a sequel immediately.
I know. That's exactly. So that's basically what we've done. And the sequel now just becomes integrated with the book. So, but the problem is that the sequel is, you know, it's not like we just wanted to tack on this kind of, okay, well, you know, we have some new insight that we want to share. We kind of have to go back and make the whole thing integrated and holistic, because we're, you know, artists like that. So
I mean, if you did do two full books in like a couple of years, that would be maybe slightly close to the productivity of Dr. Michael Greger, you know. So
exactly, and that's, you know, an unreasonable,
like, one-tenth
level
of the productivity. Yeah. How many books has he written in the many years? It's just incredible.
He just churns them out. It's amazing. So yes, if we had that ability, we would certainly use it, but we do not. We're
mere mortals.
Lazy for that. Yes, exactly.
Well, for any listener that still has not signed up for the Living Wisdom Library, you can actually read one of the chapters in the upcoming book by becoming a lifetime member. And so you can do that at esteemdynamics.com and become a member of the Living Wisdom Library. And not only that, you can hear Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk do a, what is it, twice a month or so, a live Q&A, a video Q&A with the members' questions.
Exactly. Yeah. 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 It's basically the weeks that there is not a Beat Your Jeans tends to be the week that we do a membership Q&A. So, yeah, we have a chapter of the book, and the lifetime membership remains the only way to get on the list for the book when the book is out. And so that's not imminent. You know, it's not definitely still a ways down the road, but we're not publishing anywhere else. So that's going to be the only way to get it.
Wonderful. Well, all right. Well, what do you say we get into some questions and then see where that leads us, Dr. Hawk?
Sure. What do we have?
All right. Our first question is as follows. Dear doctors, should I be worried if my boyfriend's career seems to be a higher priority than me and our future family? If I was the love of his life, would his career still be more important than I am? He's 40 and a financier on Wall Street. I'm looking forward to hearing what you think about this.
So I immediately want to know a lot more about the context here. It's sort of, you know, it's almost like Goldilocks sometimes on the podcast, where questions are either way too long and detailed or they're too short. And this one is, it's a little short for me to know what's really going on. So, you know, how do we know that his career is a higher priority than me? What sort of feedback are you actually, like, the literal feedback that you're getting? I want to know more about what that looks like, and how much of that is subject to your personality distortion. If you have a personality that needs a lot more of a certain type of affirmation that you're not getting from him, then you might feel like he cares more about his career than he cares about you, for example. So we need to kind of suss all that out and sort out the reality of, you know, does he really care more about his career than he cares about you? Is that a truthful statement? And then, you know, kind of what is his relationship to that trade-off? I mean, he's 40. He's sounds like quite the dominance hierarchy climber if he's working on Wall Street. He is in a time in his life where he is absolutely seeking to achieve the highest heights that he can, as evolution is driving him to do. So in principle, he can attract the most quality mate that he can possibly get. So does that mean he is trying to do well at work so he can trade you in for a better model? Maybe, maybe not. That's going to be a lot of women are going to be afraid of that if they're getting rejection signals by someone who's in this, by a male who is in this stage of his career and seems to be prioritizing work over them. But we would have to really know the details of what that looks like and how. So, all right. Okay. Well, some technical difficulties there, but we're back. So, so I understand, you know, having those feelings of potential rejection if you're getting cues that, you know, he's spending all this time at work and he's putting all of his time and energy into trying to advance at work. But at the same time, that is exactly what you want: a driven, successful, high provisioning, paraban to be doing. It doesn't necessarily mean that you don't qualify or that he would want to trade you in or anything like that. It's sort of this, there is a trade-off here that females make to some degree of, if you want the signals that come from a high quality mate who is climbing those dominance hierarchies and seeking to prove himself in the world and to do well, when he is in this stage of life, that is going to, on occasion or quite frequently, look like he is valuing work more than you. And that's part of the trade for that kind of male. If you chose instead a male who had no drive and you know, was not kind of putting himself all in at work and was very much more oriented toward you and toward family, that sounds like it would be great in theory, but in practice you might get slowly a little bit resentful. You might not be as attracted to him. There would be a other set of problems that goes along with that. So, baseline, we just need to know more details about the specific situation to help this lady out. But I always, when I talk to women who are in a situation like this, I really like the work. It's a little woo-woo. So if you're not woo-woo and you're not open to woo-woo stuff, then definitely don't read it. But there's an author named Alison Armstrong who writes in this very kind of stylized way. She has several books. One is called The Queen's Code, I believe. One is called Keys to the Kingdom. So you kind of get the idea of the theme. And she stages men's lives into, you know, prince, knight. Knight, knight, prince, king.
I don't know. I don't fall into any of those.
But the idea brute. That it... At different stages of men's lives that map roughly onto kind of decade, you know, they're at different points in that achievement cycle, and they're seeking to prove themselves in different ways. And so when you're dealing with a prince, which is who you've got right now, he's really consolidating that empire. You know, he's really, this is when he has to make his mark so he can inherit the kingdom, so he can, you know, prove himself. It's not until you have the king, who's very settled and very accomplished and very doesn't need to prove anything to anybody. He's won his wars already. That's a different sort of dynamic, where you're not going to have him at the office, you know, fighting those wars all the time. But at the same time, you know, he doesn't necessarily need you as much either. So she's very skillful at talking about those trade-offs, and what that looks like, and what women can expect at all of those different stages.
That's a fascinating way of describing that. Because I look at my dad, and he's, you know, he's basically won all his wars, set up his life, and, you know, he's definitely not, you know, at the office like he was when I remember growing up. And, you know, my mom commented one time, she said she remembers when he used to like wake up super early, wear a suit every day, you know, and it was a totally different, mm-hmm. totally different competitive mm-hmm. process.
Yeah. Yeah. And it means very different things for the woman in his life too, you know, so sort of the equilibrium that she gets into when he's in prince mode, to be helpful to him, or, you know, what she thinks she needs and how she gets it, and all of those things change. And so, of course, he's not the only one changing, you know, life stages. She's changing life stages too. So other people have written about this in different language. There's the famous book Passages by Gail Sheehan, I think, and other authors who were in this space writing about this. But I like Allison's work because she's also very... She's very inspired by the work of David Data, who is also very woo-woo. You get me alone on the show, we're going to talk about woo-woo stuff.
I was going to say, you wait until Dr. Lyle has to take a break.
But Data, he wrote a book, very well-known book, and probably many people in this audience have heard of it, called The Way of the Superior Man. Mm-hmm. And it's this kind of, you know, big... tome about, you know, masculine feminine dynamics and how they play out in relationships and how that can change over time. And so she's very inspired by his work and kind of tries to write more from the female perspective, essentially. But it's the same, it's this masculine feminine polarity dance, and how that energy can get confused and misdirected and misplaced and all of the things that can happen, and some suggestions for how to turn it around. But all that to say, it sounds like he's very much in solid prince stage, aiming for king stage. And during prince stage, you're just there to kind of make life easier for him. it doesn't necessarily mean that he's looking to step out on you. Of course, that could be true. And that is how your nervous system is going to interpret any kind of defection signal. And, you know, staying late at the office feels like a defection signal to most females. But that doesn't necessarily mean that's what's going on.
Okay. So what you're like, does seem like there would be a difference between staying late at the office and then somehow she's confirming that he was actually working versus staying late because he had to go out for drinks with his coworkers and didn't invite her.
Yeah, well, and the way she's phrasing the question is that, you know, there's not a lot of hint in the question that she feels like his emphasis on work is a cover story for his infidelity. So she might not even be worried about that. It's really just that he's putting his time and energy into resource acquisition instead of provision, but in principle he's doing that so he can better provision you.
Thank you, Dr. Huck. I appreciate that. And can you tell us the name of that book again and the author?
Yeah, her name is Alison Armstrong, and she has a couple of them. They're written in this very kind of storybook, chit-chat sort of way, and Keys to the Kingdom, I think, is the main one. But she's all over. You can find her on YouTube, and she's very personable, and I find her quite a delight.
Thank you very much.
She's a lot easier to listen to than Data. Data's intense. I mean, Data's great, but he is very intense. But Way of the Superior Man is also a really great book for mm-hmm. people who are interested in these topics.
Thank you so much. All right. Our next question is, now we pivot a little bit towards the woman's perspective of negativity. So the question is, dear doctors, what are the ways that women might abuse men? Is the silent treatment, inducing jealousy, withholding intimacy, etc., are those considered abusive? I'm a woman, and I found myself doing some of these things in a toxic relationship in which my partner called me abusive, which made me wonder if I actually was.
I'm not going to call these things abusive without more context. So they're not great behaviors. They're not optimal, helpful behaviors. They're not behaviors that are going to nurture a healthy relationship. But you know, where are they coming from? So are they attempts? Are they? You know, every therapist in the world, the first thing that they say in a couples session is, oh, well, you're just having difficulty communicating, right? We need to work on your communication. And what they're not seeing is that all these things that she's describing can be attempts at communication. So I don't know if they are in this scenario or not, but certainly silent treatment, inducing jealousy, withholding intimacy, those can be attempts to get your partner's attention, or to try to make a point. They're just not very skilled or artful ways of trying to communicate that. And so these are the kinds of things that are very subject to personality distortion as well. So if you have a less emotionally stable personality, if you have a more disagreeable personality or a less conscientious personality, these kinds of things are likely to be in your arsenal. You're going to reach for them more readily than someone else might. I think they exist in the nervous system of not just every female, but probably everybody in a relationship, because they are communication tactics. You are doing these things because you want to manipulate the behavior of the person on the other side, and that is by definition a form of communication. So it's just crappy communication, and it can certainly move into the abusive realm if you are doing it in a punitive way, if you are doing it despite requests to stop doing it, if you know, I mean, this is a very context dependent sort of situation. So again, we want to know more. I'm just going to default to that. I don't think they're unique to women. And I don't think anything that a female is going to do in a relationship that is toxic or potentially abusive is uniquely female. There are some things that females are more likely to do just because females tend to cluster around certain personality characteristics more than males do. They tend to be more agreeable. They tend to be less emotionally stable. But there's nothing inherently female about any of those strategies, I don't think.
Fascinating. If I can harp on the word abusive a little bit, and of course, this is all just my perspective. It almost feels like if a partner calls somebody else abusive, like that's a door closing to where you can't really solve a problem. Am I misunderstanding that, or what do you think, Dr. Huck?
I think when somebody starts calling their partner's behavior abusive, then, you know, probably the ship has sailed on the relationship to some degree. And so you're picking that up where it's this feeling of the door is closed. So I always think of John Gottman here. He's the sort of professor and therapist in the Seattle area who has his love lab, and he's very famous for being able to observe a couple in an informal setting and tell you within a minute or two if they're going to be together in 5 years. And he has this very good success rate. And it's because he looks very good success rate, like in the you know, high 90s percentile.
Oh, wow.
And it's because he's looking at what he calls the four horsemen of behavioral signals in this couple. And this is like a, it's like I'm being quizzed if I can remember all these. So the first one is contempt. Contempt is the big one. If one or both partners are showing contempt for the other, that is super deadly. Another one is stonewalling, so the silent treatment. Another one is sort of wholesale criticism, like, you know, just a general statement about you, about something that I don't like. And the other, I believe, is generalizing. And so you always do this. You never do this. And so, you know, any of those four things is problematic. Often he'll see all four of them. He's like, this relationship is completely doomed. And so I've always likened Gottman's analysis to, you're very skilled at predicting the demise of a relationship, just like a doctor would be very skilled at predicting somebody's cancer diagnosis by observing a tumor. Like it's, you know, you're seeing something that has already progressed to a point where the signaling that is going on is if not completely past the point of no return, it's pretty far gone. And so getting to the point where you subjectively believe that your partner's behavior is abusive, and you accuse them of it, it means that there's just a lot of toxicity going on in the relationship, and a lot of early signals have been missed. And there has been a failure to communicate has happened. The communication that was attempted was rejected because partners did not like what was being said or what was being signaled. And so things escalated, to a point where now we're in a situation where, people probably don't want to be there anymore.
Thank you so much. Yeah. This little love lab, that sounds really interesting.
Yeah, Gottman is, he's a broken clock is right twice a day. And Gottman has a lot of really good tips and a lot of really good relationship, like observations about relationships and techniques that I like to use and recommend to people. He's still very psychodynamically oriented in a lot of ways, but he's another good resource for people to look into if they need communication help.
I don't know. I think the best resource is you or Dr. Lyle, but I'm just biased here.
Well, obviously, right. Yeah. But, you know, it's also worth pointing out that, you know, there can be a degree to which somebody calling somebody's behavior abusive is also in itself a communication strategy. You're essentially trying to say, okay, you know, I'm really going to make it clear how far past my red lights you've gone here. And I'm giving you one last chance to kind of correct this and relate to me in the way that I've been trying to get you to relate to me. And like we've talked about on the show many times, including in the last couple of weeks, sometimes this is an issue of communication skills and people needing to figure out how to use their words instead of passive aggressive signaling, like is being described in this question, or in the earlier question, I guess the jealousy and silent treatment, et cetera. Often these things are coming from an authentic cost benefit analysis on the relationship, and the person is running that CB and their partner is no longer qualifying at the level that they were qualifying. And even if they're not entirely decided that they want to defect on the relationship, they are definitely testing the boundaries of it. And they're sort of pushing around and reparameterizing and trying to detect exactly where they stand and if they are reading the situation correctly. And so that's where a lot of the so-called toxic communication is going to come into play. And so you can have a little bit of a power struggle with all of that, where one partner drops the abusive word in an attempt to gain a little status in that power struggle.
Yeah, oh, that sounds horrible.
Yeah, this just doesn't sound good.
Sounds exactly how this question was described, as a toxic relationship in which the partner
Yeah. I mean, you're doing this likely because you're getting signals from him that you don't like, and those signals are probably from him coming from he's rethinking his CB on the relationship in some way. And so rather than interrogating that directly, you're testing around the perimeter, trying to figure out if any of these things kind of change the way that he is signaling you.
Mm-hmm. So would it be fair, like in the context of this question, whether the person, the woman herself is abusive, would it be fair to say that people aren't either abusive or not abusive? It just depends on the context of the person on the other end and how that esteem dynamic is playing. Is that, or am I understanding that right?
Yeah, I think that's probably mostly true, with exceptions being, you know, of course there are just horrendous people who are truly abusive just generally. and so, you know, you go look at a prison population, right? Let's go into either a men's or a women's prison population, and you're going to find some people who I'm not sure you could put them in an esteem dynamic where their personalities are going to allow them to be non-abusive. And some of that is communication skills, absolutely. But a lot of it is high disagreeableness, high instability, low conscientiousness, and you know, it's just, you can only do so much, and so some people are just kind of vicious, and they're going to be vicious in relationships.
Okay. All right, well, let's pivot a little bit and talk about video games.
Okay.
My segue was
never
poor.
A dull moment.
Yeah. But I believe you and Dr. Lau talked about video games a little bit on the Living Wisdom Library Q&A recently. So
we did just this week. Yeah.
All right. Dear doctors, you've only briefly touched on video games on the podcast, but I'd love to hear more of your thoughts on the psychology behind them. What do you link their popularity as an entertainment medium or form of escape to?
Yeah. We had a question on our other podcast. We actually have two other podcasts, I guess. So there's the membership one, and then there's the political one that we do. So we just talked about, we had a woman whose husband is essentially kind of apropos of the earlier question here, where instead of spending all of his time at the office, he's spending all of his time playing video games, rather than spending it with her. And it's upsetting to her, understandably. So I think, you know, we covered a couple of things in that question. There are lots of different ways to think about this. This is a super normal stimuli for sure, where it's mimicking, especially for men, war games. So there's kind of a very, most video games that men are going to be interested in playing are very warlike. And so there is that kind of hijacking of the natural process where he's trying to show off in the village to the other men and eventually to the females of his great war prowess. And so that process is being hijacked by the video games. So that's a big part of it. Plus all of the, I don't think we got into it this week, but you have to keep in mind that these things are designed to be addictive. It's not just that it's mimicking something in our natural history that is very stimulating. It's that it is purposefully designed, just like modern processed food is highly engineered to hit this bliss point. Video games, or social media or anything virtual has been highly engineered to capture and keep your attention. So all of the colors, all of the movements, all of the sounds, these, you know, are the same people who design the slot machines in Vegas, and they're very, very good at their jobs. And so it's a highly designed distraction that, you know, once somebody is in there, it's going to be hard to pull them out. So that those are the main things. And then Doug talked a lot in that answer about how if you have a male who is choosing to spend all of this time with video games rather than, you know, having dinner with the family or spending time with the female, you do have to wonder if he is running the CB on the relationship and if he does value her. This is kind of going back full circle with our first question, valuing her more than the time with the video game. And so the solution to that is that you start to run some experiments. You start to say, hey, you know, notice that you're spending 24/7 with your video game instead of hanging out with me. How about we have a weekly date night where, you know, we intentionally plan to go out and have dinner together and go out on the town and get away from this virtual realm and just see how resistant he is to that. See, you know, if that's something that he is enthusiastic about or if he's a little resentful that you're taking him away from his preferred way of spending time. So not that this questioner, I don't know if this questioner is dealing with that dynamic in a relationship or not, but it very often, certainly when I talk to clients, it seems to be a lot of men playing video games and kind of disappearing into their caves and not spending time with their females. So it's a combination. It can be a mate value signaling thing, but it can also be you've been hijacked by a super duper addictive process or both.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever played any video games, Dr. Hawk?
Not since I was a wee child, I think, you know, on the Atari.
Super Mario Brothers or...
Yeah. We had even... We weren't cool enough to have Super Mario Brothers at home. We had to go to friends' houses for that or babysitters. But we had like a very old school Atari where we had some really cool games. Pitfall. we had like an old Star Wars game. We had some cool stuff. But yeah, that was probably the last time I played anything other than, you know, also going to the pizza parlor at an arcade in 1987. That would have been the last time that I played a video game.
I remember when I think we got a little bit like a Super Nintendo, me and my sisters, and it was always fun to we would play, then go to bed, and then my parents would shoo us to bed so that they can play by themselves afterwards. At least my mom loved Super Mario Brothers.
Oh, yeah. My brother got a Game Boy at some point. It was a big deal. It was a Christmas gift or something. You know, they were fairly recently out. And I think my grandma got it for him. That seems like what would have happened. And the Game Boy was a hot commodity. You know, he was forced to share it with me, of course, which I'm sure he was bitterly resentful about. And so, there, you know, we had time. We each had time that we got to spend on it. And I got quite hooked on Tetris. Tetris was very compelling. And I remember dreaming about it, mm-hmm. And being very disturbed that I was dreaming about it. And so it was one of those early moments in life where I was like, oh, it's gotten into my brain. It's gotten into my brain and I don't really want it there. And so it kind of put the brakes on it a little bit for me. Just like reading, listening to Prozac when I was in high school kind of, you know, planted a little seed that made me resistant to when every therapist I ever visited wanted to put me on antidepressants. So mm-hmm. These things kind of just are little early warning signals in your nervous system. So I was highly, highly, highly disturbed that my dreams were just consumed by these little floating
solving
blocks.
the little attachment mm-hmm. problems.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. The next time that happened was when I was learning R in grad school, which is this command line statistical program. And I had dreams about R and that was like, oh God, at least at that point I could recognize that I was trying to, you know, solve, I guess that's what I was trying to do with Tetris too. I was trying to solve the puzzles. And you know, there were things that I hadn't gotten during the day that I was synthesizing at night. But it's always a little disturbing when that happens.
Yeah, every time when my mom got me into Sudoku, that's what would happen is we'd just go through pages and pages of the different skilled ones. And then by the time I'd start doing it over and over and over again for several days in a row, then I'd like think of it while I'm going to bed or think of it in daydreaming and whatnot. That's how I knew I'd like had too much and then I'd take a break.
Yeah, these are not things that we would have had around the Stone Age campfire.
Yeah.
They're definitely being registered as very important to figure out. And that's a double-edged sword.
Well, speaking of very important to figure out, we have our next question.
Oh, your segues, man.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know, I worked on them all night.
All right. I feel we need sound effects in the background. All right. What do we have?
All right. Dear doctors, I am a 35-year-old female who is afraid to talk to men. I'm so nervous when talking to the opposite sex that it's affecting my work and my studies to the point where I chose to pursue a professional degree in which the majority of students are female. I avoid interacting with males wherever I go. I always choose female doctors or dentists and only speak to female salespersons when in a store. I'm 35. I've never been on a date, which my friends, who of course are all female, and my family think is weird. I've never been traumatized by a man. I've never been raped, and I had a good childhood. I know, though, that this is not normal, and I would like to overcome this problem. Any help or advice would be greatly appreciated.
Huh. So I'm curious if she went to college, work and studies, or if she... So, yeah, she did. So she chose to pursue a professional degree. So there has been this long-standing discomfort, even when you're in kind of low-stakes, you know, situations where you have potential repeat exposure, which I think would be, if there is a solution to this problem, that's what it is. So it's, you know, find a female-dominated but not entirely female social activity, you know, hike meetup or some kind of class or volunteer activity that you could do where there are going to be a couple of men there, but you're buffered by enough females being around that you don't feel overwhelmed by it. But presumably you would have had that situation as an undergrad, which is exactly that situation, dominated by women, but you still have plenty of men hanging around. So, I mean, this sounds like there's a lot. I mean, I can hear Doug now just throwing up his hand, saying personality. It's just personality. And it largely is personality. You've had, you know, lots of kind of common opportunities that just have not affected you in the same way that they affect the bulk of the bell curve. And so you're just sitting out there sort of in your own spot. And it doesn't sound like you're scared of men, other than just being afraid to talk to them. It's not like I guess I'd want to know more about, you know, what that fear is. Is it a fear of their sexual interest? Is it a fear of, you know, what exactly is that? But there's also at this point at 35, you know, the costs of changing behavior get higher and higher as you get more and more entrenched in your behavioral groove. And so the longer you go without being on a date or having a relationship or being intimate with a man or any of this kind of thing, the more and more sort of, the more you build it up in your mind, essentially. And so the harder it gets to make that happen. And so we would approach this similarly to any kind of, exposure therapy to a traumatic incident, even though this doesn't originate in trauma, where if we could just expose you to some nice guys in a community group that you could have some conversations with in a very low stakes way without any overt romantic interest or anything like that, and just, you know, desensitize yourself bit by bit to it, that's going to be pretty much the best way to tackle this, I think.
Fascinating. Fascinating. All right. All right. Yeah, my brain kind of lost the segue, but it's okay. We'll go to the next question.
That's all right.
It's hard to figure them all out. But it's a little hard to relate to this question, I guess. That's the thing.
Well, I know
as a
women
more
like
extroverted.
This.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I've met women like this and, you know, it's unusual, but it's not unheard of. But what I have observed is that, you know, as they get older, it's, you know, they've never parameterized properly the whole dating experience. And so because they've never done it, they don't feel like they're missing anything. They're very, very in a groove with their habits and with their lives and very comfortable and very unchallenged. And so to be challenged a little bit becomes very, very scary. And so what started off as a, it's the same thing as like if you're afraid to drive on the freeway. And so you go way out of your way to take little side streets and you just never drive on the freeway. You actually, you know, we check in with you a couple years later. Now you're really never going to go on the freeway, right? Because you've not done, you haven't desensitized yourself at all in that process. And so, yeah, I know quite a few women who have caught themselves in this trap, and obviously the modern dating environment doesn't help matters. And if you're a little introverted and you're purposefully selecting environments where you're not running into a lot of men for repeat exposure, it's very easy to just avoid the problem altogether. But that comes at a price. It comes at a price where if you do decide that you want to try to resolve it, it just becomes that much more difficult later in life, but not impossible.
Do you think this falls under the like a higher on the bell curve for mate for egg guarding, or is this I mean, maybe I'm just, yeah, like is it mate guarding or high, basically? I mean, it's, this person has to be high conscientious, right?
Yeah, I think it's just, it's, yeah, I don't think it's necessarily mate guarding. Although we could, or egg guarding, but we could test that by, you know, bringing Prince Charming in and seeing if you yeah, have had reactions, if there have been men that you've been interested in that you feel, you know, differently about interacting with. And obviously that's going to be true to some degree, but yeah, I get the feeling this is more just a very nervous personality in general, and nervous in this particular way, just like the, you know, you've got the nervous house cat who hides in the attic and you don't see it when guests come over. Like 3 days later, you're like, oh, where have you been? She is that house cat. And that's fine. You know, it's not impossible to, you know, find relationships and find someone who can kind of understand where you're coming from. It's just going to be that much more difficult.
Now, how, Dr. Hawk, how or if at all would your answer change if this was a male saying that he was afraid to talk to women?
I would think it's pretty much exactly the same story. I would interpret that. I mean, if it's the same sort of self-reported, you know, no terrible story, no traumatic events, no, essentially no learned experience that is holding him back, and distorting his view of how relationships look, then yeah, you chalk that up to personality. And, you know, personality can be moved by, or can be expressed differently with a different environmental change, to some degree. You just have to discover how far that degree can go by changing the personality. And in this case, we're going to put you in a Spanish class for adults, you know, for that meets at the community college once a week. And it's mostly women in there, but there are a couple of nice guys, and, you know, maybe everybody goes out afterwards and wants to get dinner or hang out. And so you can find yourself in social situations where there are men around, but it's not in this sort of, really scary situation where it's one-on-one. And, you know, bring girlfriends along with you on these endeavors as well, to be your wing women. That's going to be helpful as well.
All right, Dr. Hawk. So our final question for this evening, dear doctors, I am a student in my third year of a Bachelor of Psychology. No matter what the subject, the courses always manage to devote a section to gender theory.
I'm shocked.
Yeah. It's taught as a fact that gender is a series of norms socialized into us and have no basis in biology. Where does evolutionary psychology fall on gender theory?
Oh, man. Yeah, it's not at all surprising that you're being inundated by this. This is going to happen anywhere in the social sciences, psychology, sociology, political science, all over the place. We've talked about this to some degree before. But yes, at some point in the last, I don't know, even the last 10 years, this has become no longer an issue of debate. It is just absolutely everything is blank slate. Everything is social norms that socialize into us, can be fixed by the right institutions. I'm old enough to remember when this was just a paradigm that we would look at among many. And so, you know, that you would sort of consider something like gender relations or even relations between states to be subject to social norms as a theoretical, hypothetical question, not the sort of status quo of instruction. So I feel for you that you're being exposed to this. I don't know that I can speak for evolutionary psychology broadly on where it stands on this question, other than to say it is, even though evolutionary psychologists are not biologists, they're happy to take a stand on biological sex and the differences between men and women, and that are rooted in biology predominantly. So that does not mean that there is not a social aspect and construction of gender that happens. So this would be an interesting conversation to have with Doug, because I have a feeling he would be a little more potentially conservative on this question than I am. So I am open to a discussion around the ways that we could think about biological sex and gender differently. So again, that used to be the kind of the gold standard for the way that this kind of question was taught when I was getting my bachelor's degree, which was, you know, biological sex is biological sex. You got the chromosomes you have, you're the sex that you are, but you know, depending on your social context, you might experience your gender in some other kind of way, whether it's a completely opposite sort of way, some more fluid way, or something that is essentially more incentivized by your social structure, which we have currently found to be very much the case. We have a social and political structure in the Western world right now, which very much incentivizes gender fluidity in the expression thereof. Does that change the reality of biological sex? It does not. And so this got conflated and collapsed at some point in the last couple of years, and it totally baffles me how that happened, where you now have, people straight-faced in psychology classes in a bachelor's program saying that all sex and all gender are just a function of social processes, which is just insane. Anyway, that is my brief departure on this question. I'm not sure if that's totally what you're experiencing. But as far as I can speak for evolutionary psychology as a field, I think it's going to pretty much be congruent with that more conventional way of making that distinction.
All right. Thank you for clearing that up, Dr. Hawk.
Yeah, well, I don't know that anything's cleared up. It's a huge, huge, huge mess.
All right, Dr. Hawk, well, thank you so, so much. We really appreciate the candid answers, and I'm sure we will we'll look forward to hearing more from both you and Dr. Lyle. But in the meantime, we hope you have a wonderful evening, and we'll chat with you real soon.
Awesome. Sounds good. Thanks, Nate.
All right. Have a good night. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.